Hey everyone, Sedona Dave here, and welcome back to Off the Beaten Path. Last season, we looked at what makes us tick, the life lessons, the role models, and yes, the gear that fuels our adventures. This season, we're zooming out. We're asking bigger questions. What does it mean to be seen? What do we bring to the table? And how do we define success when the world often has differing expectations? We'll laugh, we'll bust some old paradigms and beliefs, and we'll shine a light on the way we carve our own trails, sometimes with gear in hand, sometimes with grit, but always with a little style. Because being blind isn't about fitting into someone else's story, it's about creating our own off the beaten path. Hey everyone, Sedona Dave here, and this is Off the Beaten Path. Today's rock star spent over two decades in the video game industry, managing and producing titles at Atari, Accolade, and Mattel Toys. His voice, sound design, and production work shaped more than 35 games, including Tempest 2000, iWar, Kasumi Ninja, and Test Drive Off-Road. A car accident changed his vision, but not his creative path. With total blindness in one eye and low vision in the other, he rebuilt his artistic life through photography, which led him to tactile art. Today, with his wife Carrie and in partnership with the Andy Warhol Foundation for Visual Art, he developed a process that transforms photographs into touchable artwork using texture extraction and 3D printing. How about that? Their tactile images debuted at the National Federation of the Blind National Convention and have since appeared at galleries and accessible art events nationwide. Today, he runs blindtravels.com and speaks nationally on accessibility and art, travel, and technology. Please give it up for Ted Takechi. Ted, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Hey, I don't need to say anything else. You've done a good job.
All right. Well, great having you. Any questions?
Yep, thanks. Have a good day.
Ted at ted.com. Nice. That's been a while. I've been looking forward to getting you on ever since I met you a couple years ago.
Last time I saw you was last year in Sedona. We were shooting for the Tactile Art Project.
It was last year. That's right. And you were the winner of the Flight for Sight Award.
Their travel grant. Yep.
Right. And then you were doing the Grand Canyon. You're doing the national parks for your project.
Well, we did a bunch of different stuff. So we did do the national parks. We did Sedona. We did Moab and a bunch of other stuff. I also did Rocky Mountain National Park and stuff like that. But okay. I mean, you know, before we get too deep, we should probably talk about what the project is, right?
Let's dive. Let's go. Let's grab our boots and go hiking. Let's back up just a little bit. Who are you? What you got? And what are you up to?
And my name is Ted Takechi. Thank you again for having me, Dave. I really appreciate it. And my goodness, in the 80s, I started making games, like you said, for Atari, Accolade, and Mattel Toys. Made 35 different titles. I was a manager of, project manager for those titles. So kind of in charge of everything to do with the game, from design all the way through graphics and managing the teams. And at the height of my career working for Mattel Toys as the senior product manager for the Hot Wheels division, we got into a car accident, lost all the sight in my right eye and 95% in my left. So I can see blurry shapes, and that's pretty much it. So I made the decision to do probably what's the most insane thing that a person who is partially sighted could do. And that was go back to school and get a degree in fine art photography and studio art photography.
Fascinating that you were attracted to that as a newly blind yak. You were attracted to photography. Fascinating.
Yeah, Visual art was a big thing, obviously, in the games industry. I've always loved visual art, and I studied photography when I was in college before I started working in the games industry. And then that kind of led me, you know, that bug never went away. You know, once it bites you, it's always there. So I was sad that I couldn't see it anymore. So for a lot of years, I just, you know, found a new way to capture the world with a camera, if that makes sense.
It'll make sense when you unfold. But it's great that you were introduced to photography, the lens, prior to your accident. Probably really important to, like, I want to continue that. All right. So now that your eyes are gone, tell us about your photography. Now let's get into the neat meat and taters of your project. This is amazing.
Right. Yeah, so the project, originally I started carrying the camera around with me because I couldn't see the things that were going on around me. I have twin boys. They're 29 now. But, you know, at the time I couldn't see them, you know, blowing out candles on a birthday cake or, you know, swinging on a swing or anything like that. So I would bring the camera with me and I would, you know, take pictures and blow them up on the computer screen and basically, you know, use it as my kind of link to the world. And that led me back into doing, you know, artsy stuff. And that's what got me back into school. And all through the years that I was at school, my wife Carrie and I, you know, she really wanted to find a way to be able to, for me to be able to see the work that I was creating, because obviously I couldn't see what I was creating. Mm. So we always had, you know, like glue and poppy pens and all of the normal ways that you would, you know, make something accessible, turn it over upside down and rub it with a pencil so that it's got the tactile version of it, feel to it. So we used all of those methods. And then it was kind of frustrating because, you know, I'm a lazy guy, you know, and I like to basically have everything done for me as far as art goes. You know, I want to be able to, like, push a button and have it print out for me.
Got it. So
we started working with a really cool company here in Colorado called Duraplac, and we helped them develop a process that would over extrude the amount of ink that they were putting onto a piece of metal when they were printing it, to where it became embossed so you could actually feel it. And that's what kind of led me into doing, like, the accessible art, you know, and the fact that when I was in school, it was very apparent that the world of visual art is woefully unprepared for people who can't see it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We do our best to make it accessible, to make it, you know, big, or, you know, something you can really glom onto and say, oh, it's big visual art that we're not supposed to touch, but
right,
we get it. Not where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big thing, right? It was like, you know, finishing the degree in photography was miserable, because going through all of, like, the art history classes and trying to determine, you know, the difference between, like, 20 different Gothic columns and that sort of stuff, and, you know, all the architecture and craziness that you do when you study art history, and trying to do that with audio descriptions. So it became, you know, just a practice of memorizing every single thing you could possibly do, you know? So, you know, that desire to, you know, create accessible art kind of started in that realm, in that time when I was in school, and my wife was there as well. Mm-hmm. And, that led us into, like I said, the alternative methods of doing it ourselves. And then we kind of always had the process in the back of our mind that we wanted to be able to 3D print. But at that time, you know, 3D printers were like $10,000, and it was a non-starter. It wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So in 2024, she said, you know, why don't we give it a try? Cause they were down to a reasonable price. And, she said, I've got a friend who, you know, works at a local art company, and they've got a line on a grant through, Andy Warhol. So she processed that, or she, applied for that, and they were happy to do it. You know, the Warhol Foundation is always willing to take a gamble on somebody who's doing crazy things with art, because that's what Andy Warhol did when he was making art.
Yes.
You know, and, that was kind of our mentality, is that we wanted to follow his credo in that, you know, he wanted to make art accessible to everybody, not just people who could afford it. We want to make art accessible to everybody, not just those who can see it. And that's kind of where we're, you know, headed towards. Mm. So we created a process, and when you enter a photo or put a photo into the process, it extracts all of the texture, the light, and the shapes, in the image, and then allows you to adjust those up and down in the 3D composition. And then it goes through some number crunching and spits it out into a file that can be printed on a 3D printer. And, you know, like you said in the bio, we launched last year at the National Federation for the Blind, their national convention in Florida, and it's been just absolutely crazy ever since.
I'm fascinated. We were down in NFB, did not get a chance to stop by, but I wish I could have gotten my eyes and hands on some of your works, because sitting here now still, and I've been mulling this around in my brain for a year, I still can't get it. I still can't grasp. For example, say, all right, you just took a picture of, and this is my model. This is how, let's describe this scene. Blue sky, a sailboat on the water. So a bright white sail, you know, sharp points, you know, a sharp peak, blue water, bright sun. What would that feel like?
That's actually a very good example. So when we do the extraction process, if there's anything going on in the sky, like cool clouds or whatever, we can adjust the amount of that texture, and when we can adjust how aggressive that texture is, and we can adjust how high or low it is in the 3D composition. So if you want really, if the clouds are important in the composition, then we will, you know, bring that up in the composition. But in what you're talking about, obviously the boat would be the primary subject. So the boat and all of the rigging and all of the, you know, the bits and pieces around the top of the boat and everything like that would be brought up and would be emphasized by the texture extractor in our algorithm. And it would spit that out along with however much texture you wanted to have in the water, because water's going to have waves and it's going to have, you know, lines and that kind of stuff. So you basically adjust all of those things in there, and it does a lot of thinking, and then it spits it into a file that can be printed on a 3D printer. It's really neat. And like, for example, we went and shot the Golden Gate Bridge as one of our things for the, one of our trips for Flight for Sight last year. And, in the actual rendered version of it, in the tactile version, you can touch the Golden Gate Bridge. You can feel where the cars are driving. You can feel the arch below where the road is. Mm-hmm. And then you can follow those cables all the way up, and you can feel each cable along as it hits to the spire for each one. So it's really cool. It's really fun to kind of run a fingernail down that edge of it. And it's really, really well done. It's really got a lot of fidelity, a lot of resolution, which is kind of counter to what a lot of the Braille displays are right now. And when we developed the process, we made it so that it was forward thinking, so that when Braille displays become more higher resolution, this will be able to transition right into being able to use with those, as well as physical media as well.
Okay. Got it. I get that you can feel the cables. That's a great example. That's a structure. That's a man-made structure with straight lines. You could feel that. What would a cloud feel like? Because you're printing on a 3D printer, so it's not soft and fluffy, I'm guessing.
Right. No, it's not. No, but we can adjust the amount of texture in anything that's in there. So if the cloud has the cloud shape, but it's not, you know, obviously going to have those bumps like a bridge would or architecture would, we can soften that all out. That's all in the process once it's actually going through the final evaluation process before it's prints it out. It's really a cool process. It's really neat. A lot of people that experience it for the first time, you know, we had a lady that flew to Florida for the debut of it. She's lived in Boulder her entire life, and we knew that she was coming, so we went and shot the Flatirons in Boulder, Colorado here, and brought one specifically so she could check it out. And she said, I've lived my entire life in Boulder and I always heard about the Flatirons, never understood what the big deal about it was until now I've been able to actually see it. And she's been blind her whole life. It was just amazing. If we would have gone and just done that one thing for that one person and quit tactile photography, you know, it would have been a win, right?
Nice. That is beautiful. It's a beautiful story. Changing lives on that one. And I love to see this technology and these processes advance, what is the future of this? Do you feel or see or envision?
I think, you know, we've gone through multiple versions of our process. We started with kind of abstract stuff, and that's where we got into doing it, was with the Warhol Foundation. Mm. I have a body of work that is a exploration of the human form in black and white. And so they're naked bodies, but all of the naughty bits are, you know, it's cropped so that you don't see those, right? Mm. So it's all these kind of like sweeping, you know, nicely lit, you know, body parts, whether it's like a stomach or, you know, whatever, but, you know, there's no, like I said, there's no naughty bits.
Right.
And that was the thing that got us into doing that. So they're more abstract, and obviously abstract stuff is super easy compared to, you know, recreating the Golden Gate Bridge in tactile, you know? So iterating that process really has been our primary focus, is that, you know, version one was more abstract stuff. Version two, into version three has been, you know, really getting the resolution down for, creating like the Golden Gate Bridge and mm-hmm. other things. And specifically like Sedona. I mean, Sedona is one of our most amazing prints. It's a Sedona sunset, and it nice. Could not have been more perfect weather, as you know. I've heard that you know about Sedona weather and how beautiful it is there.
Honestly, we're in the middle of a 5-day rain event, so it feels like,
oh my gosh,
it feels like Thanksgiving in New England right now. I'm freezing, but yeah. 99 days out of 10, it's gorgeous. So you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, we were there in September or December last year, and it was absolutely like 65 degrees. It was gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. It's not 65 today.
Much nicer than here in Colorado.
It is beautiful. So, and you're right. We do get our infinite number of gorgeous sunsets. I mean, every day is just a magnificent sunset. And I know you were able to capture some gorgeous scenes. I'd love to get I'd love to get that Sedona sunset in front of me to really experience, because I see that all the time, and for me to experience through your lens what I experience through mine, I think it'd be brilliant. So let's plan on doing.
I'll send you one out.
Plan on hooking up someday really examine your wares. You're not just using.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm dying to know about your equipment, because you're not just using an iPhone 6 camera.
No.
And my dad was a photographer as part of his life, so I, you know, the dark room and the whole everything that he did with film. But then they're all SLRs and all sorts of stuff I don't really understand, but I know my phone takes okay pictures. My wife takes great pictures. What kind of equipment gives you your successes, you know, that gives you the quality platform to do this art?
Well, the technology will work with an iPhone, because at the end of the day, what it comes down to when you take a great picture is the light, right? And it doesn't make any difference whether it's indoors, outdoors, whether you're using a flash or whether you're just, you know, waiting for a nice sunset. It really is your time of day. And especially, you know, getting up early and, you know, being there for sunset, you know, those are the two times, you know, sunrise, mm-hmm. sunset, and, you know, being there for the right time. And of course, you know, every time is, you know, a little bit of luck behind it, right? Because you mm-hmm. never know if you're going to get that great cloud in the right place or whatever. And I don't do a lot of, crazy manipulation. I try to keep them as true to the actual vision of the photo itself, which is kind of very counter to today's AI, you know, just right. type a button or type it in and say, give me a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, you know? So it's there. It is what it is, but I try to keep it as true to the original image as I can. But I use a Canon 5D Mark IV, which is the kind of the big boy DSLR camera. And our process doesn't require a specific kind of camera to work, which is really cool. When we do the capture, it will work with almost anything, which is really cool. And then the printers that we use the Bamboo Lab X1C, which is kind of, it was the top of the line until they, you know, released a new one, which is of course, you know, iterating technology, seems like it happens every minute, but they're really forgiving printers, which is really cool. So you can do a lot of crazy things with it. Cause for the most part, a lot of people are just doing little tchotchkes with the 3D printers. They're making like cable holders and, you know, all that kind of like little boats and everything like that, dragons and everything. And that's what most of the 3D printing technology is, you know, is these little cool little tchotchkes.
Sure.
And you know, the 3D printing technology or the 3D printing community is, it's really an amazing community because no matter what hobby you're into, there's always a big community behind it. And the 3D printing community is crazy. And once they found out that we were, you know, creating art, especially for people who are in the blind and low vision community, support has been nothing but, you know, 100%, you know. So, you know, every couple of months we have somebody that backs up a truck and gives us all the plastic that we need to be able to make these prints and everything like that. And it's just, it's amazing. It really is great.
And the printer lays down a polymer or a plastic.
Yeah, so it comes on a big 1 kilogram reel, and basically what it does is there's a hot end. The filament goes down into the hot end and it heats it up to a specific temperature depending on what kind of filament you have, and then it basically like prints it line by line on there. So it for us it prints a big square star or big rectangle when it does the base of the print, and then after that it starts filling in like the shapes of the mountains or the shape of the Golden Gate Bridge or whatever. And it really is a neat little process. It just, you know, makes art out of just reels of plastic.
Okay, and it's durable, right? I'd be afraid, like, you have this beautiful Sedona sunset, I touch it and it breaks. There goes your sunset.
So the pieces that we've had so far, I think we have 10 or 15 pieces that we normally bring with us and show. And I would say that those have been with us since the National Federation of the Blind launch in Florida. And they've been, you know, felt by, you know, 5,000-8,000 people. And they still feel the same. But if there was anything that ever happened to them, it's just a file. All I have to do is push a button and it'll print it out in a couple hours. So it's not a big deal.
Got it.
It's totally replaceable, which is great. And that's kind of where we wanted to be, was that, you know, when we were in school and we were doing all of the, you know, the puffy pens and the paint and all that kind of stuff, we were, you know, having a lot of work to do with the creating the tactile art. And now once we have it done, we can push a button and it can print it out as many as we need, which is great.
Okay. And
so we've put in at the VA in Long Beach, which is really cool. So they we did wayfinding maps. This process is really great for creating maps and that kind of stuff because of the resolution and the detail. And we actually did pictures of the area, the coast around the VA there in Long Beach, and it's been amazing.
Is that a wacky yet brilliant idea or thought? I know the hold on, stand by, helmets, chin straps.
I'm sorry, I got to go, Dave.
Great job, Dave. I know that O&M instructors, part of their realm is intersections, crossings.
Yep.
3D printers and mapping and street crossings, take a picture of and glom it all together. I don't know what my question is, but talk to me about it.
Could it happen? Yes, very easily. So we are actually working with a couple of different cities on the East Coast right now. You know, not ready to name anything yet, but we have the engineering blueprints for a bunch of different intersections. We've created the 3D prints, and then those go right into doing a mold that you can pour in metal into it, and so that can be, you know, completely weatherproof and everything like that, and touchable and everything. So, and last for forever. We're there. We're already there. Wayfinding is a huge thing with this process. And, it really works so well that it's completely automated, which is wonderful. Cause like I said, I'm a lazy person, so I want it all to do it for me.
I hear that. I hate to say it, but, I know exactly what you're saying about that. what you're doing is just is phenomenal. How you came up with, you know, with this concept, and you really hit the ground running. You've got an amazing experience. I'm really curious, what's a part of your experience that you wish more people understood? Not just the sighted folks, but other blind people as well.
The personal experience of really, I would say, people need to understand that vision loss is a spectrum just like anything else is. And that's the thing, is that it's really difficult for a lot of people to think in terms of that. Like, for example, if you're mobility impaired, right? Mm-hmm. You can use a cane. You can need a wheelchair. You can be, you know, completely immobile and need the epic wheelchair, right? And that's easy for people to see because they can see it. And the problem with blindness is that it's not one size fits all, and it's not just a on and off switch. And I would say that, you know, people need to understand that blindness can go all the way from I can't see without my glasses all the way to I have no light perception at all, right? And there's everything in between. And that's always been the hardest part about dealing with other people, especially who haven't had a lot of experience with people who are partially sighted. And that's really where my Blind Travels website comes in. You know, I traveled for work for so many different years, and it ended up, you know, I was making notes every time I came in, you know, on what was going on in the hotel and that kind of stuff. And that led into kind of a database of hotels, you know, in different states that would tell you where the front desk was when you came into the property, tell you where the pool was from the front desk, tell you where the elevators are, you know, the restaurant, like important wayfinding points, right? Rather, because you can't always rely on people that are in a property to be able to give you accurate information, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where that whole thing came from, right? Was being able to give people a tool that would allow them to travel more effectively and more confidently. And that's kind of where that came from. So, you know, we're expanding that, you know, it feels like every day we're expanding it. I've got a bunch of different articles on there now for education for the travel and hospitality industries, about how to effectively deal with people who are in the blind and low vision community, how to, you know, more effectively serve them and to work with them. Cause a lot of people have questions, you know, is it okay for me to use the word see? You know, I would like you to look at this. I'd like you to see this. Right. And, you know, for the most part, you know, blindness is an individual journey, right? And some people who are in the blind and low vision community don't like those words, right? Mm-hmm. And other people don't have issues with it because that's a normal way, a normal cadence of speaking, right? So it's one of those things. So there's a lot of questions that people have who are fully sighted about, you know, the way that they can serve us better. And that's been a big part of the creation of that Blind Travels website.
Mm.
As blindtravels.com, by the way.
blindtravels.com, yes. As it's spelled, as it sounds. Really important. I love your answers, because that, in a nutshell, is an entire conversation or three. The sensitivity,
the planet did
big sigh, you know, the sensitivities, you know, I was talking to some other guy, fully sighted, and he said he let it slip, you know, do you see? And oh, he felt so bad. And like, now I'm feeling bad for him. Feeling bad. And like, it's this codependent circle.
Right.
You know, I'm okay with it. I guess some people aren't, but it's so individual, so personal. And the sighted community has no idea what to do with it. You know,
no, they don't.
They don't know how to, I don't know how to.
And a lot of them are really hesitant to talk about it or ask about it. And that's why I do so much, you know, outreach, especially, you know, with this whole art thing has really allowed me to have a platform to talk to people who are fully sighted, like especially artists, right? Mm-hmm. And to get the word about how they can make their work accessible for people who are blind or low vision, right? And that all starts with social media. If you're going to post something on Instagram, write a darn alt text, tell people what the description is, describe your work, and you know, start there. And if you do nothing else, then you're making the internet a better place, right?
That's super, super important, man. You're really hitting it at the grassroots level. How to talk to a blind person, how to, you know, we don't bite, but yeah, you know, right. Ways of engaging us or introducing us to art, to surfing, to, you know, hiking, to everything.
Travel.
To travel, right, right. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. And again, there's a huge conversation to be had about individuals and how we are, or to what degree we're sensitive to the languaging. And, you know, I dare say, I do believe it's a sighted world out there.
Oh, very much so.
It is in our language. And I know it reflects that. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but yeah,
exactly. Well, and I think about COVID, right? I go back and I think about COVID, you know, when that first week or 2 weeks or whatever, and you go into a grocery store and they've got signs everywhere on the floor. They're stuck on stands and everything like that say you need to keep 6 feet apart and you need to be on this side of the aisle and yada, yada, yada. Well, guess what? You know, I couldn't see any of that stuff. My guide dog couldn't see any of that stuff, right? She didn't understand that she needed to stay 6 feet away from people. It's all the same thing. It doesn't matter, you know, and COVID isn't the only example. It's, you know, just travel in itself, right? And trying to find your room in a hotel, trying to find your seat on a plane, you know, all of these things that are just, you know, take that extra step for, you know, living as a person who can't see.
Yeah. Yeah. And then entering a different culture where things are done differently. As a blind person, I stumbled into the wrong car on a train in Dubai, women and children only. And it was terrifying, terrifying that I did not want to be there. Don't mess around in Dubai. It was terrifying. I am so, so sorry. Yep. And as soon as those doors opened, my wife and I were gone. You know, please, you know, don't.
Yep.
Sorry. Didn't see. Sorry. Couldn't say sorry enough. That right. But no, it absolutely, it is a sighted world, and we get to muster through it.
Well, and like you said, it's a grassroots movement, right? And the important part is when you are a person that is partially sighted, you know, in any way, to any level, that when you're interacting with people who are fully sighted, right? Getting seated at a restaurant, getting to your hotel room, getting to your airport, you know, to your gate at the airport, it's important to pay that forward as much as you can, right? So help where you can, help people understand people, you know, what you need, help people understand that, you know, we're not glass, you know, and we are okay with it. We're, you know, big boys and girls and, you know, you don't need to grab us and drag us to a, you know, to the gate or whatever. You can give us directions, you know, and we can get it, you know, and it's totally fine. And that's the big thing too, is I think that a lot of people that are in the service industry have people who are maybe a little bit more like ultra independent and don't want the help. Right. So, that might turn them off and make them hesitant about asking other people, you know, in the future if they need help. So
yeah,
it's one of those things.
Yeah. I perceive it as a bilateral kindness, or Aini, you know, it goes both ways. As we ask and they offer their assistance to us to help us through the life, I've got to remember that I've got to be kind as well. You know, just don't grab me. Don't, you know, there are things not to, you know, please don't do that. But, you know, if I snap and, you know, someone doesn't do something right, and if I'm a jerk and I stop, that's probably the last time they're going to want to help a blind person. And that helps nobody.
100%.
So
right. It gives the impression of all blind people are angry and don't touch it, you know, whatever. Some people, you know, with the guide dogs or whatever, they just roll up and they just start petting your guide dog. And, you know, the next thing I'm walking into a wall because my guide is distracted. And right. It's a good learning experience to say, look, you know, this isn't meant in a bad way. It's just to kind of give you the information that, you know, you need to make sure that the person that has that's holding that handle is in a safe place, and then ask them if you can test their dog or whatever, right? And it's use everything as an opportunity to teach people if you have the time. Now, if you're in a hurry, sometimes you can't, right? But, you know, that's what I try to do to help people. So
grace, you know, whatever level of grace we can muster at the time. In an airport, nah, we're on the move. But yeah, when there's a smattering or a modicum of kindness to be offered, I'm all about it. I really am. It's community. It's our community, the sighted community, and the merging of the ecosystems, so to speak.
Indeed.
Yeah. On that note of success and the sighted versus the unsighted, what does success mean to you as a blind person navigating a world that's really biased towards the sighted right-handed person?
I would say changing perceptions. That for me is a big success, for not only for what people who are in the blind and low vision community are capable of, but changing perceptions that it's okay to offer help. It's okay to, you know, like I said, we're not glass, you know, and this summer, I'll tell you a little story. For my Blind Travels blog, I was traveling, cause I still do a lot of the retro game conferences. So they drag me all over the US to talk about the games that I made and all that kind of stuff, which is amazing, you know? So it gives me an opportunity to travel all over the place and to be able to talk to people, which is great. But this summer I decided that I was going to run an experiment, and most of the time I wear glasses that look like normal glasses, even though I don't have any sight, because I wear the glasses so that the 5% that I have in the one eye, I try to protect it as much as I can. Right. So that's why I have the glasses. They actually have no prescription. But they're there if in case, like I hit a tree or something like that, that's hanging down or whatever while I'm walking, to be able to protect that little tiny bit I have left.
That's brilliant.
So I think because I wear that it gives people the impression that I'm okay. Even though I have a cane or have a guide dog or whatever, I think that it feels like maybe they're hesitant to ask, or, you know, maybe not as willing to ask. So this summer, over the course of three different trips, six flights, right, going to different places, I wore my regular glasses and I wore my my black wraparound sunglasses. And the perception of what a person is wearing dark glasses inside and has a cane is completely different than somebody who has regular glasses with lenses that you can see through. And people treat you night and day different, which I find fascinating.
Interesting.
Yeah. So this whole summer I spent doing that. I went to six different places. I went, or six different legs on a trip. So actually, not to plug, but literally yesterday I posted a article on my Substack, and you can check out my Substack at Nedskee, Nedskee. It's free. You know, and I don't charge. It's one of those things that it's just, you know, my ability or my, you know, platform to be able to write and, you know, tell stories about games and tell stories about being partially sighted and art and everything else. But, you know, I kind of chronicled the whole thing over the course of the summer and talking about the perceptions of people when they saw me with the dark glasses versus regular glasses. And then, like I said, it was a fascinating experiment for me, but there was a little bit of guilt, right? It felt like it was maybe a little bit performative, right? That I don't necessarily need to have those sunglasses because I don't have ultra light sensitivity like a lot of people do. But it was a really interesting experience.
Let's crack that open. I'm really curious about, because I've got my, obviously we all do, my personal experiences of how I'm perceived. I've right. got the dark glasses on, and you know, sometimes they are on inside, but they're always on outside. How are you treated differently between your clear faux prescription glasses versus the dark shades inside? I mean, I'm fast. I'm dying to hear this. I'm all ears.
Yeah. So same, different crew, same airport, same time of day, going in one day, people hesitant, had to find my way to the desk to get some help to my gate. You know, I use Be My Eyes or Ira or whatever to find my way to the gate most of the time, but this was an experiment. So I was coming in as a blind person. And, you know, with regular glasses on, totally hesitant about that. It was like a week later, same time of day. It was like early in the morning, so it wasn't like crazy, crazy busy. Still DIA, Denver Airport here, wearing the shades, and 100% different. Walked in the door, literally like 1 foot in the door. Somebody's like, "Hey, how you doing? Can I totally help you? I'd be happy to help you. You want me to get somebody to find your gate?" Blah 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 blah. And I thought, okay, that's kind of strange, right? So then, Portland, you know, landing in Portland with my regular glasses on, same kind of deal. Landing in Portland the next week. Dark shades on. As soon as I get off the plane, kablam, they're there. Would you like me to call you a wheelchair? Can I have somebody help you? You know, if you don't want a wheelchair, do you want help just finding the baggage claim? It was 100%. Not that the people were like falling over themselves, but it was 100% different experience with and without the dark shades. It was like the whole Clark Kent thing, but in reverse, right? You know, he takes the glasses off and he becomes Superman. You put the glasses on and suddenly you look like a blind person. You know, it was weird. Anyway, you can read the whole story. I blah blah a long time about it, but it's interesting. So
it's fascinating. What an amazing study in human behavior. I've obviously had no time to process this, but we went into a story yesterday, just, you know, just inane. We just had to get who knows what, you know, Basha's or Safeway. And the guy looks at me in the door. He's like, "Are you blind?" Hey, no, that's
right.
Yes, I am. Thank you. Have a good day. Yeah. But that consistent experience that you are picking up is just.
Yeah, I like that you don't look blind. That's always right, the right, favorite. And people don't mean it in malice. They just, it's just, you know, hey, you don't look blind, right? Because no, I got regular glasses on rather than the dark shades. But,
right,
you know,
right,
it's just so interesting, that whole perception.
Right, to look blind is to have your arms ahead of you and flailing around like a knucklehead or you know, the tin cup. Or we're an interesting breed, man. I'll tell you what. We're a very interesting members of the society that...
I can really see how people who are in the blind and low vision community can get exhausted with it, right? From people treating them very much that same way. And it's very easy to get sharp with people and very easy to get, you know, kind of a bad attitude about it. And that's why I always try to, you know, wave my arms about the, you know, this person probably doesn't even know. They don't have any clue, or this is what, you know, their experience. You don't necessarily match their experience of what a blind person is, right?
Exactly.
Blind person has a white cane and they have sunglasses, always, period, end of statement. And, you know, anything else is not blind, you know? So it's so strange.
It is. And there is that stereotypical, you know, that we all imagine, white cane. Well, guess what? That's part of our get up today, white cane. Dark glasses, guess what? That hasn't changed either. And I do recall standing in front of Safeway. My wife went in for a quick, you know, a quick something about a month ago. And I had my coffee mug with me. So I had my white cane and I had my coffee mug with me and a dark shades. And I'm standing in front of the boy, am I stereotypical or what? But, you know, it is. I don't mind being blind. I am on occasion I could be proud of it, because we do get to do cool stuff, and not just go to the bathroom at night without breaking toes. We do get to stay in the game. Sometimes it's harder, but we do get to. So I am curious, how do you feel when you see another blind person doing something epic, like something unexpected for one without sight? Does it feel inspiring, pressuring, or something else entirely?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe like somebody who makes awesome canes. I don't know.
But does that inspire you?
it totally inspires me. And I definitely see that.
What's it inspiring you to do?
Right. It really inspires me to that there are people in the blind and low vision community that are striving to be awesome or to be excellent. But I also really can't wait until that feeling of inspiration eases. In other words, when more people in the blind and low vision community are doing epic things or figuring out things that they can do that nobody else can, or are doing, you know, something awesome, whatever it is, making, you don't have to make crazy tactile art or make canes or whatever. You can do the thing you do, right? Whether it's, you know, writing on a, you know, a platform like Substack or something like that, and becoming a great writer, right? You can totally do that, right? You don't have to do something that will interface between the vision world or anything like that. But when that becomes mundane, then that will really be awesome for me. And that's kind of what I'm really looking forward to. So I'm always inspired by people who are doing awesome things. You know, I try to do everything that I can on my end to try to, you know, feed that awesomeness for anybody who is there, because I feel like I was there, and I feel like, you know, I had a really amazing job. I made video games, and I could not have been more passionate about my video games and about the games that I, about that entire industry. But losing sight and suddenly not having that career that was so awesome, hurt. And it was absolutely destroying to me on so many levels. And it took me a really long time to get my head around the fact that, you know, being blind was a new normal for me, and trying to figure out how to make that work and how to navigate the world and all the things that, that, you know, all of us that are in the blind and low vision community have had to do. And I knew that I, you know, wasn't doing it. I wasn't treading a road that hadn't been tread before by any stretch, right? Everybody's that's in that, in their community has done that. But also it was my road, because I was a big boy in the game industry, and all of a sudden I wasn't in the blink of an eye after a car accident. And, you know, it took me a really long time to figure out how to do that, how to tread that road. And it was a really long time. You know, I talked earlier about, you know, going to these retro game conferences and stuff like that. And it was 20 years before I could go back and do anything. And a friend that I worked with at Atari called me up and said, "Hey, we're doing a 30th anniversary for the game that you created, and it's, you know, a bazillion seller. You need to come out and you need to be there to talk to people." And I'm like, "No, I've had nothing to do with that part of my life since I lost my sight. I didn't want anything to do with it." And he called me back the next day and he said, "Look, I know you're going to hang up on me, but you need to come and do this." And I said, "No." So he called me back the third day and he said, "You're coming to this because your ticket's going to be in on your Southwest account tomorrow." And I'm like, "Damn it." You know, and it was okay. It was totally fine. I, you know, have traveled by myself a million times. I got to the convention center, and boy, I tell you what, I walked in the door and they have all those free arcade games. And the first time I heard Asteroids or Dig Dug or Pac-Man and heard those sounds again, it just ripped my heart out, you know. And it took me a really long time to, you know, kind of work through that emotionality. Right. And, you know, thank goodness I had my friend, you know, he was there. He's like, "Hey, how can I help you through this?" And I said, "Okay, let's just go to my favorite game, which was Dig Dug." I said, "Play a game for me and tell me what you're doing." And he did it. And that was it. You know, it made it easier. Right. And that was the way that I needed to cope with getting through and figuring out what my new normal was. So completely, you know, way out of what you were asking, but and another story. Sorry.
What an epic. I mean, how pivotal. What a pivotal. This is what it's going to take to get you back on that horse. Define the horse. It's not getting back into the arcade industry. It's life. It's getting that joie de vivre, that reason to get out of bed in the morning, that I know we struggle with. And that's what it took for you.
A lot of people do.
The soundtrack to your childhood or your early adulthood. That's those games. Heartstrings, brother, heartstrings.
It's rough. And I was just in Portland this last weekend, and it's getting easier, but it still hurts. So,
okay.
but it's really cool to be able to talk to the people that made the games that I made. So it's that really is kind of a bit of closure for me. Cause I left that industry so quickly after the accident that, you know, cause obviously I couldn't see anymore. I couldn't do my job. So left that industry and had no closure for, you know, my departure or like the getting final numbers for the titles that I had sold. And, you know, some of them did 10 million units, you know? And it's, so it's like, and every once in a while over the course of that 20 years, I'd meet somebody, you know, that would find out that I worked in the games industry, and they'd say, oh, I played that game. That game defined my childhood. And it would be like, oh, okay, well that, you know, that's tough. And so there was all kind of like the seeds, you know, over the course before I actually went back and got back and involved in the retro game scene. So it was, it's been a wild ride.
Yeah, it has been. And a question popped into my mind that I really need to ask. Let's see if I can remember it. Just need one quick second. Car accident, loss of vision, and then you seem to almost compartmentalize your world, and like, this is my career. I do the video games, and now that I had this car accident, I don't have my eyesight. I've got to close this door, and do something different. I guess fortunately or otherwise, my personality is very much dovetails that, where something happens, I'm done with it, I have to close it, you know, just burn that bridge and move on. I don't know if that's always my best decision. I did that in school, you know, I was supposed to be a corporate pilot. Then I got the diagnosis. You know, I could have stayed in airframes and power plants or meteorology or the power, you know, right, all sorts of stuff. But I said, nope, if I can't fly, I don't want anything to do with it. And now I'm building canes out of titanium.
Which for me.
And it's interesting. So I just want to pick your brain a little bit on that. If you can just shed a tiny little light on, and again, I don't know what the question is, but your strategy of like, okay, that's done, and now I'm going to do something different, maybe not completely different, but in a different direction.
Well, for me, it felt like you were saying, you just need to close that door. And I think for me at that time, it was the right decision for me to do that, because the problem was that the games industry obviously didn't stop because I wasn't there, and you know, it was going to continue on, and new consoles came out, new games came out. And every time that somebody would tell me, you know, oh, I played this great new game. Oh, sorry, you're not able to do that anymore. You know, that always just killed me. Right. And because when we talk about something that you're utterly addicted to, and I was from the time that I got my first Pong game and hooked it to my old black and white TV in the living room, back in like 1976, right? Before Star Wars came out and before the big Atari 2600 came out. That was my life, right? And I played games. I had a paper route growing up. I bought games with my paper route. I eventually got a better job just so that I could buy better games and buy more consoles. And that was my whole life. And then, you know, I was in college, and then I got out of college and went right into the games industry. And I was in the radio industry for a few years and then left that and headed into the games industry and never looked back. You know, it was just like a summer job kind of deal. And I went from, you know, playing the games, worked my way up the ladder and started doing that. And then, you know, suddenly it was not there, and not being able to have anything to do with it was like, you know, quitting smoking or whatever vice, cold turkey. And it was doubly difficult because, like I said, I have twin boys, and at that time they were like 5 years old, right? So they're doing kindergarten, they're doing soccer practice, and I'm missing all of this, right? So I'm trying to figure out, you know, how to navigate the world as, you know, oh, dad, you know, Jaren and Jordan's dad is blind, so be careful around him, you know. And it's like, I'm not glass. I don't really care. Just, you know, so, and you know, we roughhoused like we always normally did, but there was things that I couldn't do, obviously, like playing ball in the backyard and that kind of stuff. But, you know, just navigating that, finding a way to navigate that world anew. And for me, like I said, turning that off, and even though it was very difficult for me to separate myself from people that I had known for 20 years in the industry, I needed to have that separation, and I needed to have that out of my life, for a clean break. I mean, I guess I don't know. And it felt like every time somebody mentioned games, then it was still there. And I still, you know, like somebody that's addicted to something, I've always want to have it back. Right. I mean, right now, if I could play a game of Super Mario Brothers, I would do just about anything, you know. It would be amazing. But I can't, but, you know, so it's one of those things, and getting back into it has helped. But, yeah, just for me, that was the right decision to just move on in my life. And I don't necessarily know that I mean, photography is another thing, right? I picked up the camera and used that for other things, and I could have walked away from visual art as a whole. But I didn't, you know. I still love visual art. I've always loved visual art. And it's just one of those things that, you know, I found a new way to do it. Right. And that's kind of the new mantra is now all of a sudden it's like, okay, I can take pictures of the Golden Gate Bridge, and now I can actually run it through our process, and I can feel it. So I can see the shape, right? And with my little limited vision, but now I can feel everything that I'm missing. And that really is the key for where we are right now with the tactile photo stuff.
Okay. Beautiful. So not a loss. It was just a pivot.
Yeah.
Strength.
The whole life has been a pivot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what we do. It's what we do.
You make do with what you got.
Yeah, Berlin. I really enjoy chatting with you because you're very cerebral. There's a lot that goes on upstairs, and I appreciate that. All right, one more question I ask everybody because I love the question. I'm fascinated with your answers. If I were to offer you this can of Cure It All, you drink it now, tomorrow morning you wake up, 20/20 bilateral, you've got full vision. Would you take it?
I think in a heartbeat, and I don't think that it would be a yes for the reason that you think it is. It isn't because I want to play games again. It would be a yes because I feel like it would give me a stronger footing in both worlds, because living this life for as long as I have and having the experiences that I've have given me a very solid footing in the blind and low vision community, and being able to solve some problems for the blind and low vision community has really been a big help for me. But being able to actually see and to drive a car and to do the things that people who are fully sighted could do would be more of a convenience than it really would be anything else. I mean, the games would be nice too, but at the end of the day, it would really be for a convenience thing for me.
Okay. Heard. Driving. Cause I think about that not all the time, but, today's cars are different. It's not just an engine block and a high rise manifold and a carburetor and a wing nut at the very top. They're different. They're smart. They do things. They brake. They steer. I personally would be absolutely terrified to get behind the wheel again. There's just too much. And then would I trust the vision? Oh, you know, I'm used to not seeing anything. Am I seeing it all? Am I, you know what? I like the right seat just fine.
Would the reflexes be there? It'd be a big question for me, right?
Would the reflexes, that's right. Right. Would I even know what to do anymore? We'll leave it to our drivers. I'm pretty comfortable in the passenger seat now, I dare say. But interesting, the conveniences. I totally get that. I 100%. And I appreciate your response. And everyone's is different, and they're all equally as significant and the right answer. So thank you so much for that. Ted, we are out of time. Mickey Mouse says, all right, time to go. Again, I always appreciate talking with you. You've got a lot of great stuff happening between those earphones of yours. I love what you're doing. And let's hook up at some point because I got to get my hands on that Sedona sunset. One more question about that.
And if you, yeah, go ahead.
Are they monochrome, like one color, or is there any color added to the printing?
So that's where we started. We started with monochrome stuff because for people, we wanted to try to expand the audience for it as much as we could, right? Yeah. And for people who are completely blind, right? It doesn't matter if you're using multiple colors or not, right? You could just do it as the shape is what's important, right? So the shape is there, but our printer, the one that we use, does multiple colors.
Love it.
So it does like the base and then it switches over to the second color, the lighter color, so that people who have a little bit of vision like me, you know, can still see it. So it's got a very nice strong contrast to it.
Nice.
And then the other thing that I didn't mention too is that when you experience one of our photos, right? So it comes in three parts. When we exhibit the work, the first one is the regular photo and for people who are fully sighted, and then the tactile version, like we've been talking about. And then the third piece is a plaque, and on the plaque is a large print, label for the actual, what the picture is called. There's a Braille label on it as well. And then there's a scannable tactile QR code so that when you scan it, it brings up on your cell phone, it brings up a audio description of the original photo. So it tells you the mood and the colors, the time of day and all that kind of stuff. A little bit of history in the case of the Golden Gate Bridge and that kind of stuff. Ooh. And then what most importantly, it walks you through what you're feeling in the tactile version. So that it gives you the kind of the full context of what you need to experience this, whether you're partially sighted, fully sighted, or somewhere in between.
Love it. I'm so glad I asked, cause that wrapped it. That just brought it all together. So appreciate it. Yeah, there's always that one last thing. I know we got to go, but okay. How can we follow you? What are your handles?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So on social medias, Twitter, X, whatever it is called this month, Blue Sky, Substack, you can follow me at Nedskee, NEDSKEE. That's pretty much everything through all of the social medias. Blind Travels has a Facebook page, which I don't use as much as the Blind Travels website. Obviously, like I said, you can go to blindtravels.com. And if you're interested in the tactile photo stuff, it's just tactilephotos.com. And everything is on there. The site's totally accessible. It's got audio descriptions for all the photos, talks about it and all kind of stuff. And something that you are the first one to talk about, which I'll be the first place to talk about it here, is my wife is fully taking over the tactile photos portion of the organization. Mm. And she's starting a 501c. Nice. So we're going to be launching that next month, so that what we want to do is, you know, it's really easy to sell tactile photos on Etsy or whatever, or eBay. And the problem with that is that you're only getting a few people to touch the work. We want to have the work available to everybody. And our goal is to be able to walk into a museum or a gallery or an exhibition, you know, whatever public space, and have tactile versions of the art that is available. And we want to use the 501c to subsidize that cost of the printing. So that's, terrific. You know, to try to bring it down for smaller places. Because obviously, like big galleries, they can afford it, you know, but for smaller galleries, you know, and there's a million and one small galleries, to be able to offer them the option to have a lower cost version of these, you know, still same quality, but just subsidized by the 501c. Up for these tactile photos, that's kind of what we're aiming towards.
Terrific. Wow. that is something to follow. Definitely gonna keep my spidey senses on what you're up to out there. Ted, we could probably talk all day. I so appreciate your time. You got great everything, great stories. Thank you so much. And keep doing what
you're
doing.
Appreciate you having me, man.
Follow.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Ted, be well. Thank you so much.
Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Off the Beaten Path with your host, Sedona Dave. We hope you enjoyed today's interview as we explore what lies beyond our perceived limitations and challenge ourselves to seize life's opportunities. If you're ready to leave the couch behind and get some dirt in your boots, then join us on our next show. As always, you can head over to awerewolfgear.com to sign up to our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. That's it for now. Until next time, on the move. We'll be right back.